Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 36 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. the Superman Lover. And I'm joined here by my sensational co-host, former market maker of 20 years and present-day retail trader, a former bouncer whose silhouette resembles that of a large land mammal. Surprisingly, he wears a lot of Ralph Lauren, but is not with the horseplay. I'm talking about Saskatchewan's beloved son, JJ.
JJ, how you doing?
How's it going?
You're doing good, brother. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, man. Excited, honored for our guest today. He's a man who was born and raised in Southern California. He received his bachelor's in theater from UC San Diego. He then moved to New York City, where he's been on the small and large screens and stages. You know him as Ben Kim on the hit Showtime series Billions. I'm talking about Daniel K. Isaac. Daniel, how's it going?
Good, good. So you're Superman, not Batman?
You know, honestly, I do like Batman better. I don't know why you had to bring that up. I do like Batman better, but.
All right. No, I'm with you there. I didn't know if we could continue with this interview if you were that pro Superman, I think.
No. I'm pro Batman. I respect the intellect, the smarts. But when it comes to maybe the affairs of love, I'm more like Superman. But let's move on. Daniel, but no, like I was saying before, man, pleasure for joining us. I just want to start off. I want to ask you, what's the climate right now in New York amidst, you know, the lockdown and, obviously all the protests happening?
Totally. I'm in Queens in Astoria, so it's a little quieter here. It's a sort of hot and muggy day today for literal climate. And I feel a sense of unrest, yes, but also maybe a potential for hope and change with this unrest. And right. So I love this city and I call it home, and I'd like to believe that it'll result in change for the better, hopefully. So I will throw an optimistic slant on it for now.
Yeah. Also, no. I feel optimistic as well. I've already kind of seen it. It seems like there's sentiments changing, at least a little bit, or good things are happening. It's funny in Astoria, Jay. I'm sure you have some funny stories about it.
Well, yeah, I had those interesting clients in Astoria.
Yeah.
But were they mafia related?
Well, when you work in trade in Vancouver, you end up, you know, like you're very familiar with Hall on your show. My clients were all kind of like Hall.
He's one of my favorite characters and human beings in real life.
Oh, interesting.
But, that must be an interesting dynamic to have worked in. There are paint stores and like travel agencies that are long outdated and I am convinced are not real. Oh, and chandelier shops. That was
That's right.
Totally spiked my suspicion. Like, who those buys are the best chandeliers in rentals in Astoria, Queens right now?
Those are the
best. I think no one. Yeah. So, please don't put a hit on me. I respect your business.
Yes. Yeah. Man, we love your business. Great. Keep up. You
know. Right.
Do the good work. That's funny. Daniel, being from California, so you, it sounds like, yeah, you, like you said, you call New York home. How was it when you first moved out there? Like, change of pace?
I feel like I was constantly told I smile too much to be a New Yorker. So I think 10 years later, people haven't really said that to me. So maybe it really does go away, or the city hardens you in a bit, in a certain fashion. But other than like beaches and all around monotonous, beautiful weather, I do love the city more, and the pace of it feels more in line with what I come alive in. So
cool. So how have you been? You know, spending your time on lockdown, have you been able to be productive in the house?
You know, my therapist a couple weeks ago was like, please resist the urge to be productive when there's a global crisis. because I think as many children of immigrants, I imagine, and Asian Americans, compare self-worth with, or, you know, tie up self-worth with productivity.
Right.
And so in some ways, like, I have dusted shelves I've never dusted before, or, you know, like, cleaned parts of the apartment that I didn't know existed, and reorganized bookshelves and little house projects, I guess. And I also have my writing, and so I'm grateful for that, to have some sort of artistic agency in this time. But I've actually struggled with that desire or need to be productive when we're going through a pandemic, and, you know, survival for yourself and your loved ones feels paramount, and you know, my work is at a halt for now, because in person, like, work is sort of the necessity for my for my artistic expression and job. So my partner works in finance, and he's been on calls, and, you know, has two monitors, and has been busy this entire time, and I've been like, well, maybe I will read a book today, and maybe I will binge this TV series I've always been meaning to get to, and that can count as productivity. How about that?
That's funny. Well, I think that's a good perspective, though, or good advice from the therapist. I didn't think of it in that manner, because, you know, we could definitely, like, overwork ourselves, or be too concerned with being productive to where it becomes a detriment, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So, Daniel, you know, I see a lot of similarities between our professions, you know, trading and acting. You know, I believe you know, and I'll go into it. You know, I believe the chances of making careers out of both of them are extremely tough. You know, the odds are stacked against us.
Totally.
Yeah, because, you know, and I believe that's why we have to have, like, a strong passion for these pursuits. Mm-hmm. Where does your passion for acting come from?
Wow. I know that I love it, and so I can live and breathe it, and that I know that it is a source of joy and love for me. I think a part of it is mixed up in sort of a stubborn rebellion in my upbringing, and that which was expected of me growing up as a good Korean American, you know, child of an immigrant, shirking the, you should be a doctor or a lawyer. So, I know a part of my love is mixed up in, oh, cool, I'm doing this thing that makes everyone unhappy, and some, in some fucked up way, that makes me smile. So, I do recognize that, and yet it was also my, like, very conservative religious Korean immigrant mother who introduced me to theater in the first place, and said, you know, all great people in life are good public speakers. I don't want you to ever have stage fright. Why don't you try out some theater at our church as a way to never have to struggle with that? Never imagining that I would stick with acting in theater and this profession for the rest of my life, but she can't really fault me for pursuing it when she introduced me to it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow, that's interesting.
That's good.
Yeah, you know, because while I was saying a bit about, like, having the passion for it, right? Because, like, you don't land every role you audition for. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to win every trade that I make.
Right.
So, right. So when you do fail, maybe you've even gone on a streak of, you know, didn't get this role. How do you let that from disturbing your mental equilibrium?
Oh, man. Yeah, it's rough. Before Billions, I was still waiting tables, bartending, even the first couple of years of Billions, I was still doing that and catering, personal assisting, handing out flyers, just every survival job possible. And I would go through streaks of auditioning where I wouldn't land the part, or I'd be really close and then it would go to someone else. And it's easy. I think it is easier to fall into a pit of despair or frustration or anger about repeated failure than it is to try to find, I don't know, the good spin on it. And so I would try to activate goodness for myself. And so if I went on an audition, I would immediately go to a restaurant I liked, or a coffee shop I loved, or a bar I liked, or go shopping to try to forget the audition itself, but also to treat myself like a puppy in training, just to find something joyful after something that I knew was hard, or if I really wanted it, or was challenging, or maybe felt impossible. I would try to change the energy of that in myself by A, forgetting about it as soon as possible, so like a forced amnesia, but also trying to create the goodness that I wanted in the moment by doing something that I could do proactively, because I think so much of life can feel helpless or out of our control. And so I would do something that I was in control of, like going to that Korean barbecue I loved, or getting that great martini somewhere, or buying a new shirt or whatever, so that I could, that Parks and Recreation catchphrase, treat yourself. So I was treating myself, and that kind of helped in the little ways, which I think add up for sustenance and the marathon that I think we're all in, no matter our occupation.
Right. Absolutely. No, good advice. Yeah, no,
that's healthy.
Yeah, no, I have, it takes a mental fortitude to keep going past defeat after defeat after defeat. And, I just highly respect that, no matter what type of field they're in. So Daniel, tell us about the Billions audition. How many auditions do you have to go through?
I only auditioned once, I think. It was just one scene in the pilot, the one where he talks about going to Stanford Wharton and sort of thinks he's the cocky new hotshot, and then Axe kind of takes him down a peg or 10.
Yeah.
And I was auditioning at, the pilot was cast by A.V. Kaufman, who does a lot of indie film usually, and she brought me in, and the character was called Ben Kim, so I appreciated that there was a Korean American character in finance, which I thought was honest, but also, a cool opportunity that the writers were making, acknowledging there are people of color in the finance world, and I didn't think anything of it. I followed my personal decree of audition and then forget about it. And I think the audition was in December, early December, and then we were shooting the pilot in January. And so I must have heard pretty quickly that I was gonna get the part. And again, I had learned at that point to not get your hopes up. And because, I'd been close to projects, or I'd booked things that had fallen through. And so I just thought, cool, I only worked one day for that episode. I'll have one day, I'll meet Damian Lewis, Band of Brothers is really moving and incredible. And how great to get to share space with him for this day. And my scene partner was Nathan Darrow and House of Cards, him working as the driver assistant to Kevin Spacey's character. I just thought cool, this is what an interesting day I will have in January of 2015 or whatever. never imagining or allowing myself to like get my hopes up, because I didn't want to get disappointed or hurt, really.
Right.
And so I guess I was lucky in that I only auditioned once and didn't think anything of it, and something came of it. And then we shot the pilot. And again, I had shot pilots that hadn't gone anywhere. So I thought, who knows if this will move on. I'll have just appreciated this event for what it was. And then I was doing a play in the spring, and I remember getting an email about the show getting picked up, and them saying, like, cool, do you want to do a couple more episodes in the office? And now here we are 5 seasons later. And so I'm super grateful that, you know, I can like point to a project and say, this changed my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Did you, once you knew you guys were getting past the pilot, then was it a moment of celebration for you, or was it still kind of like, oh, you know, no telling where this could go, or you didn't know the impact that Billions was going to have?
I didn't know. I think I have a cautious optimism, or at that time, especially from, like, there was one big film that I thought I had booked, and then, do you remember that film, The Interview, with Seth Rogen?
Oh yeah.
And, yes, yeah.
And and it invoked the rage of North Korea.
yeah,
that's true.
Uh-huh.
I was going to be a part of another film set in, you know, fictional North Korea, and they pulled the plug because of the like vitriol and like mass fear that North Korea would retaliate on Hollywood, which is just an absurd sentence for me to say out loud, but was a truth of the time. And so that was one of those instances where I felt so close to something, and then it was taken away from circumstances out of my control. And so, you know, even with Billions, I approached it as just, you do the thing, you do the job, and that's that, and who knows what will come. And so when the offer came to do, I can't remember what number episodes they were, but they were like, you'll do the second episode and then maybe the 5th and the 6th one. Because even the writers, they were creating the show as they were going, and they didn't know. And, you know, they don't make promises that they can't keep. And so it was like 2 or 3 episodes in addition to the pilot. And I thought, hell yeah, like how exciting. And that'll be that. And as I shot episode 2, you know, I would get an email that said, why don't, we'll need you for episode 3 and maybe like 7. And then I would shoot episode 3 and they'll say, we'll need you for episode 4 and like maybe 9 and 11. And so by the end of it, we were shooting episode 12 of the first season, and Brian Koppelman was sitting with a bunch of us in the ACTCAP trading floor in, the like fake Connecticut set we did in New York, and like, which is like an hour outside the city. And he was hanging out and asking, oh, how many episodes have you done, Kelly? How many episodes have you done, Dan, who plays Mafie? And, and everyone was saying their number. And then they came to me and said, now how many episodes have you done? And I said, oh, this will be all 12. And they were shocked because you're just writing the show. They're not like thinking about who's in how many episodes. Yeah. And then season 2 happened, and that same thing happened again, where they said, we'll need you for this, you know, like these 3 episodes. And, oh, I guess we'll add you in for these other, you know, 2 episodes. And the end of season 2 happened, and Brian asked that question again, like, how many episodes have you done? How many episodes have you done? And, it came to me, and I said, oh, I've done all 24 now. And so it was nothing that I could plan, and they didn't plan it either. And yet, in hindsight, every opportunity built on itself and allowed me to continue to stay on the show. And, you know, it sounds so trite, but really has changed my life to be here with our truncated 5th season, 54, 55 episodes later. Mm-hmm. And that I am only super grateful and excited by that.
Awesome.
But I could never have predicted it, you know?
Right, right. Well, you know, I it was another similarity I thought of between our professions, right? Daniel is the, you know, you said you temper your expectations, or almost like going with no expectations. It's the same thing with us, right? Because going into a trade, if I think I'm going to hit a home run trade, it's just not good for my mindset. You need to stay no expectations. If it works, great. If it doesn't, move on. Just worry about the process.
Yeah, right. Like the journey is more important than the destination. And it sounds like a fortune cookie, but still, like,
it's true.
When I apply that, it makes it more worthwhile when you look back on it, and like maybe allows for less struggle when you're going through it.
It does. I think it allows for less struggle. And then, like, even what you were just saying, like, you're so grateful. And just like coming from a state of gratitude that billions worked out the way it worked out. And I think, I just think it's a good mindset to be in. So that's awesome. Great to hear that. So Dan, I mean, I guess you answered this question. I was gonna ask you next. You know, obviously you said it changed your life. So I imagine this opens up more opportunities, right? I mean, are people like, contacting you? I mean, or like,
I remember, like between season one and two, I still was waiting tables. And there's a building in New York called the City Court Building. And I worked at a steakhouse in the basement of it. And in that high rise, there are a bunch of finance folks that I didn't know when I was, you know, waiting tables and bartending there all those years. Until after the first season of Billions was airing. And I would go to, like, take someone's order or get them a drink. And they'd be like, oh, you're that Asian dude from Billions. And I thought, oh, okay, people in the profession are recognizing this TV show about finance and government and how cool. But then it came to a point where I couldn't, like the restaurant was very high paced and you were always running around. But if a table was like, let's talk about Damian Lewis and Paul Giamatti and Axe and Chuck and all these things, like I was sort of stuck there talking to them. And that, like, changed my mindset of, things will be different now interacting with strangers or with the public as they watch a show on cable that I, you know, we never know if who's watching it or who cares about it. And in TV and film especially, whereas in theater, you know, like, the audience you're interacting with. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very pleasant surprise. And and then, like, somewhere around season two, I had like a deal with the restaurant where I could just pick up shifts when I needed, which is an actor's dream in New York or in any city, to have a survival job that you can sort of call into and say, hey, I'm free this time or this time. Do you have any work for me? And we were shooting season two. And it was around Christmas time, and I thought, well, why don't I just pick up a couple shifts to make a little extra to, you know, pay for Christmas presents or whatever. And and the restaurant was on like an app where you signed up for shifts or whatnot. And I went to log into the app, and it said, you are no longer a employee here.
Really?
And I thought, oh, yeah. Like, the restaurant had quietly let me go. but also because I hadn't been working there for X amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And that felt like its own sign of, all right, this is a chapter of your life that's passed, whether you like it or not. And, you know, maybe one day I'll have to go back to waiting tables. Who knows? But, for now, for that time at least, it was in hindsight that I realized, oh, okay, I'm not going back here.
Moving right along, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And like Dan Soder, who plays Mafie, worked at Dos Caminos, like a couple blocks away from the City Corp building where I worked at Hillstone. They're called like Houston's and other names around the country. Okay. And so we had both been like waiting tables on finance bros, we called them.
Yeah.
And then became finance bros on TV instead.
Yeah.
So, gotta love it.
Yeah, totally.
That's so funny. How is Dan on set? He's a stand-up comedian. I seen his funny, by the way, his HBO HBO special.
Special is so good, right?
Yeah, he's funny, man.
So funny. I was lucky enough with a couple other cast members and crew to go see it live, and he in real life is just as funny. And I feel like I straddle the introvert and extrovert spectrum right down the middle. But if I'm next to Dan, then I can be totally quiet and happily laugh along to his monologue or whatever joke he's workshopping or just whatever story he's telling, because he is so funny, so genuine. And like, you know, you want people at a party who can like bring the life and the joy to it, and he is that person at the workplace, and it's incredible. And we both come from single moms and our only children, and so like our empathy meter is high, and we both live in Astoria, Queens, and so we would share cars home after work and stuff, and he's like the big brother I never had. He's great. So funny. Watches HBO special. He has one on Netflix. He has one on Comedy Central.
Cool.
He's good people, you know.
And you know, he's very natural at the role that he plays on the show. I notice a lot of guys I worked with. You know, I worked in kind of the older times in the 90s and 2000, and on those desks, and Maffee and definitely Dollar Bill. Those are, you know, the two types of personalities that we, you know, we had a lot of those types of guys. So it's nice. It kind of brings back memories.
That's awesome. It's so cool to hear, like, when we are playing these fictional characters in finance, that it actually reflects the real world.
Yeah.
You know, like my friends who are doctors don't point to Grey's Anatomy and are like, that's my hospital. We go through all of that drama all the time. Like, it doesn't work that way. And I know we like totally fictionalize things on our show for dramatic and like storytelling sake, but it's cool to see that represented for sure.
Yeah, you guys do a really good job. And just to quickly, like, you know, are you allowed to talk about the guys who coached you from the street, like guys like Josh Brown and stuff like that? Or
my, like, even this season, I called Turney Duff.
Oh, Turney
was on your our boy podcast, right?
Yeah,
we love Turney.
Kelly, you
we
guys,
love
like,
the Duff.
Raved about him with Kelly. I love Turney, and I can text him or call him and be like, "Hey, what does this mean?" Because I don't know finance at all, and I've never traded or bought stock in my life. And so someone like Turney, who was a consultant for us for many years, it means a lot to be able to like ask him questions. And of course, our bosses, our head writers and creators, Brian Koppelman and David Levine, are so great and informative and like happy to share information. But I like to do research myself, and so Turney has been a great lifesaver, life preserver. To contact when I'm like,
and he's such a nice
13F or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I was just talking about those today. No, Turney's such a nice guy. I only met him the one time back in the 90s, and it was in a place of ill repute, and we were both faced. And even though he probably didn't remember me, he was still kind enough to come on our show.
That's amazing.
You know? It was a long night and a fun night, but yeah, he's a really nice guy. And when he was working for a big fund and I was just a lowly penny stock, trader, and he was very, very kind to me. So he was very approachable, and that was when he was rolling.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. You know, Daniel, I'm gonna go on a limb here and say, like, I mean, at least for me, I think this is one of the best written shows, I mean, maybe all time. I mean, there's abundance of quotables. How many writers, I mean, yeah, the quotables are insane. Like, so many great quotes. How many writers are there? Because I know there's like a writer's room. I follow them on Twitter, which I love, by the way, because they give you some insights on certain things. But tell me about that.
So Brian Koppelman, David Levine, executive producers, writers, like the heads of our show, incredible talented, like, fonts of knowledge and pop culture references and everything possible. The writer's room, I don't know the, like, exact number, but, like, on a tiny tangential note, I will say, like, we had our bosses, Brian and David, are such great people in that, like, we had an assistant in the writer's room who this season is one of the writers for the episodes themselves, Emily Hornsby. And so, like, to see my bosses be the type of people that fosters future talent, right, and, like, literally puts their money where their mouth is and gives this person a voice and a job from, like, rising from the writer's assistant level is so cool, and, like, so honorable, and I find rare in the business. Mm-hmm. And so I want to say, like, 5 to 7 people in the writer's room. Okay. I can't, like look at IMDb right now, and I know they when the pandemic first hit, they, like, went to Zoom right away, and I really respect that, like, everyone was available, and they're spread out. Like Ben Mesrich, who wrote Bitcoin,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Bitcoin Billionaires.
Based in Boston, and, like, mm-hmm. Stephanie Mikus is based in LA, and Adam Perlman was in LA and now in New York. And I know, like, the room assembles prior to shooting, and then sort of disbands, and then works remotely. And so, they are, like, I'm biased, I know, but they are incredibly talented, so good, and it's so cool to be a part of something that you're proud of, and I don't think that always happens in any occupation. And so I can look back and say, or, you know, live in the present and say, like, how fucking awesome to be a part of this with the best talent in front of and behind the camera.
I agree. I mean, I love how it's like they have old school references, but it's modern at the same time. You get some of old school New York, then you get modern day New York. It's just a perfect blend in my mind of both,
right?
Just fresh. It's like,
mm-hmm. I fully have to Google things when I first get the script and things like, oh, what is this reference? What is this athlete? Who is this, mm-hmm. You know, author or whatnot? And then I think that, like, really enhances the experience of watching it when you know a reference and think, oh, I'm on the inside of this. Or if you have to look it up and find, oh, there are so many more layers to what was just spoken. And like, what a joy to get to see all the depth to it. That's in a toss away retort or like a funny comeback or whatnot.
Right. It's like I this is funny. I used to what we were talking about when you first joined off the podcast, right? I was watching Billions with, I can't watch it with women. Like when I'm with women, they're like, because I can't miss any like little dialogue for that point. Like you're saying,
it's like a show like jam packed with like references and like nonstop dialogue. It feels like theater in that way, or it feels Shakespearean where you can't miss a single word, and all of it's been perfectly crafted as a part of this larger puzzle that you won't realize is the puzzle until after the fact. And it happens in the episode and then like with the season, and it builds on itself. It really is a remarkable feat of our creators, Brian and David, and the writer's room, that they're weaving this intricate web that's self-referential and like taps into modern times, but also because we shoot before it airs, like it feels like it predicts the future in crazy ways. And so,
and it's also a lot of it is so realistic. Like I remember the one episode, sorry to interject, the guy that they were trying to raise money with, and they really didn't want to, you know, fraudy. And, you know, and they didn't want, you know, to have to call him, but he had the connections with the money. And, you know, and I've been in that situation so many times where you've had to go to a guy that you really don't want to have to go to raise the money to try and close a deal because you just can't close it. And, you know, it's just like, so parts of that were like, oh my God, this actually feels like stuff I've gone through, you know?
Yeah.
I'm
one of those weirdos that can't stand the sound of chewing. And so for him to be eating all that seafood and chewing so viscerally.
And
like
slurping.
Really, yes, it's just so many noises I do not like. But it's so perfect for that character. And so for you to say that, like, reflects your real life, makes me feel like immense pity for your past with those people.
Oh, no, it was, I mean, like, we had a guy called Bloated Gary, and he was kind of the same way, right? And nobody even really knew his last name. He'd call over the, on the overhead, and people would just go, it's Bloated Gary on line 3, right? Or just say it's bloated. And so, but he was like that too. If you ate a meal with him, there'd be food flying all over the place, you know?
Oh, man.
So it's really realistic. I'm like, oh my God, how did they got that? They nailed that one, you know? Yeah.
It's like when I waited tables and bartended, we would get to know the regulars and you'd be like, here's that person again. I think we called one person, this is horrible. I'm sorry if he's listening to this, like bird something. Basically, he like put a bunch of condiments on his dish and then would like kind of like mash it all up so it just looked like a pool of vomit, and then he could eat it. And it's just not a pleasant experience to like walk by that and think, how is your meal, sir? And it's just a puddle of orange and brown. And you can't tell if the chef cooked it well or not because it is not distinguishable in its current state. So, for you to be trading with interesting characters and for them to have nicknames, that feels like a spot on thing.
He's got nicknames. Nicknames for everybody, right, Jay?
Everybody had a nickname. You know, it was just that's the way it was back in the day. You know.
Well, yeah, I mean. And Daniel, you guys, you know, not only is the writing exceptional, it's complemented very well with great acting. I mean, the whole cast really incredible. I want to ask you this: one of your scenes. How did you enjoy the elevator, that little elevator dancing scene where Wendy told you to do a bold action? How was that?
I feel like. Well, I don't have a dad in real life. And so I've always looked at Brian and David as these like surrogate fathers that the universe has gifted me.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I feel like I straddle the extrovert and the introvert spectrum. And so on set, I probably read more as an introvert, because if you're next to someone like Dan Soder, who's regaling you with the funniest story ever told, what need is there to speak? And interrupt like pure comedic gems coming out of his mouth. And when they wrote that episode, Brian and David had pulled me aside a couple episodes before and said, you have this thing coming, just be prepared for it. And then like the episode was approaching and they said, we're hiring you a choreographer to work on this episode. And the choreographer had worked on Beyonce's concerts and music videos. And I thought, okay, this feels like a big deal. And then when you read the script and it's like, Ben Kim strips in an elevator, I thought, all right, this is what I get. Because I think we were shooting that season and Kelly Acoin, who plays Dollar Bill, had seen an Instagram of mine that was like a photo shoot where I was half naked in a lake as part of a calendar that was about giving Asian American men sexuality, because we are often neutered in media representation, mm-hmm. and just in general, mm-hmm. In societal perspectives. I think we were shooting a scene in the conference room and he like passed his phone around saying, this is Daniel half naked.
Oh my gosh.
And I've never confirmed this, but I feel like Brian or David must have gotten wind of this half naked picture of mine and thought, great, we will make him half naked on Billions. And it is the true definition of hubris and Greek mythology coming to bite me in my ass, that I had to take my shirt off on the show in the midst of like a winter body and in front of Union and David Costable, who plays Wag, like my favorite people, and then complete strangers. And the whole episode being about this character overcoming his own shyness and reticence, it felt like a life lesson Brian and David were bestowing upon me and my own sort of life path and journey and voice. And whether or not they intended that, I do find that I will die at the age of many decades from now, hopefully, and this elevator scene will haunt me to my death, but will also be a mark of this is what you did and this is what that journey was, and how great to have that sort of immortalized in this scene. And I'll never forget like Damien's reaction or David like playing around and be like, you can touch me and do whatever you want, and playing with his mustache or like mussing with a complete stranger's hair. I really have to like learn all those actors who were in that elevator's name to just thank them for, you know, we do a lot of coverage on the show, and essentially we shot that elevator scene from every wall, so the door, and then the other three walls of the elevator would be taken away to put the cameras there. So it was a long time after lunch, of course, so I had eaten something, and just me taking my clothes off over and over and over again for this group of people.
Oh man,
and I'll never forget it.
Great perspective, though. That's great. That's deep in a sense as well. So Daniel, so I mean, your character, he's had good maturation over the seasons.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about it? Where maybe could we expect? Obviously, without spoiling anything, I'm sure you can't even do that anyway.
I like that elevator scene has always been a pivotal moment for me in my personal life, but also for the character, to see someone who came in hot and strong and cocky based on education and a feeling of self-worth, and then being cut down a peg or two to have to earn your place in a business, in a new environment, in a society where there's fierce competition and a cutthroat atmosphere, and I've watched this guy grow over the years from sort of being taken down and humbled in many respects to finding his voice again. The finance world, or just many occupations, have a toxic masculinity or an intensity and a aggression that may not always be easy to work in, to fit into, or to participate in. And so I think Ben Kim is someone who has slowly but surely learned the ropes there and is growing in that environment and finding his own voice. And to be someone else's new hire, to now having someone under him, feels like an evolution that our creators have been so great to evolve over the seasons. And I'm excited to see him continue to grow and find his voice, his confidence, and like whatever success can be measured as, to find and implement success in his career. In this atmosphere that's very hard to thrive in, and yet I think he's slowly thriving there.
Right. I never thought of it from the environment perspective. That's real interesting. I believe Daniel, there's two more episodes left, correct? Until
I think one more, actually.
Oh, one more.
Next Sunday will be our sort of mid-season finale because of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. We had started shooting episode 8, and we had to stop in the middle of it because of quarantine and all the precautions that our production team and our producers were great about doing a sort of ahead of the curve to protect us and everyone on staff. So
any talks about when potential to start shooting again?
I saw an article that California has allowed for production to resume June 12th, but New York hasn't announced a date yet. And I'm trying not to be a nagging person in this and pester our producers about when we can return. And so I don't know, but I know that they really do care about our safety and our well-being. And so so when the time is right, or when it can be done with respect to safety and care to all people on the crew and then the cast, you know, I hope it is soon, but I appreciate and acknowledge that it might take a bit before we can get back. And I miss everyone.
Yeah.
Sure everyone does in their own individual jobs and lives.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing too. Like, your guys, the vibe that you guys give off, just maybe just on Twitter or just how you guys interact with each other, it seems like you guys all get along very well.
I was just gonna say that. Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the truth. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like, I'm surprised at how rare it is, but I treasure that this is the reality I live in. And I'm on a group chat with these guys on T-Max, and we text every day. Or, you know, we were obsessed with Marco Polo, that app, when it first came out, and just sent each other stupid videos all the time. And you know, I texted Kelly right before this, like, hey, I'm interviewing with these guys that you did a podcast to, and I never knew you worked at a steel mill. And, you know, it sounds so cliche, but there's a whole family that's been built out of this, and I credit that to the people that have been invited or been a part of this show. And it starts from the top down, and the environment that's been fostered from our leads and from our bosses has fostered, engendered an environment where, you know, it's easier to work if you like who you are getting to work with. And there are no divas, there are no extreme personalities. It feels like a team sport, and I'm not a sports person, but like when it works like a family, it's special. I love this group of people so much. And like, as New Yorkers in this crazy unprecedented time, it makes you feel less alone and like taken care of in the socially distant way. Like, we even love Spiros, Stephen Kunkin, who's like a crazy character on the show, but is like a wonderful human, and the reason why I bought like a mask before masks were needed or required for our times. You know?
And he nails that part too, because I've had compliance officers who are very similar, not with that crazy coffee machine, that but Cortado. You know,
yeah,
that's
Steven's like real life passion that our creators Brian and David have put into the show. But then also means he has this like incredible espresso machine in his fake office. and makes cappuccinos and lattes for us while we're shooting.
That's great.
Which is that's just, cool.
You know, another perk of the job.
That's great. You know, I loved. You know, it was last episode. I love the line you said, if I can remember it. It was in regards to Spiros, because you guys were worried about him failing that test.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, someone was like, oh, well, maybe we're over underestimating it. You're like, no, I've been testing them all day. We're properly estimating it.
Yeah. Totally. That was such a fun day to shoot. And a fun storyline for the office to have. I've never taken the Mensa test, but like, our props people wrote those cards out very similar to actual Mensa questions, and it had all the answers on them, and it was fun to like play around and see what was on those cards, and to imagine Mafi being a real like easy Mensa star, and Spiro's like wishing he were with that like fake giant pin and all. so great.
Yeah, that was. So something, Daniel, I've always wondered, and I'm sure it differs from individual to individual. But how do you practice your craft? How do you improve as an actor?
I moved to New York because I loved theater and I wanted to work in the medium of theater and to pay your bills and a sort of progression in life that I could never have predicted led me to work in film and TV more. But I do think actors cannot hide and cannot sort of bullshit their way on stage, that there is no place to have a bad attitude, to not have the work ethic, to not deliver in discipline, in or in rigor, and in sort of sustaining storytelling energy. And and so I feel like you cut your teeth on stage, and that is a place that I've always returned to, and I really mourn the loss of in this time that we cannot gather safely at this time in an audience or on stage in a theater, because I think that's where magic happens, and the craft of is unparalleled. And our casting director, Allison Estrin, on Billions always says, jokingly but with complete seriousness, that we have the best cast of New York stage and film on Billions. And we really do. And if you look at anyone's resume, you can point to their theater resume too. And I think there's an incredible ensemble that has been nominated for Tonys or have done these incredible shows on stage in addition to their incredible film and TV resume. And so I personally find inspiration and growth on stage. And I sort of, I never stop devouring that. So even in quarantine, I've been watching a ton of TV and film and theater productions that have been filmed just because you can always learn from watching. That I sort of stay satiated in this time by being inspired and learning from others in what they're doing at their best.
Right, that makes
sense. Whatever the medium may be,
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, because, you know, I'm pretty sure I asked Kelly this. I asked him what was, you know, maybe the pros and cons or which was harder, theater or, you know, doing TV. And I imagine, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't act, but I would imagine theater is because maybe the element of being in front of the audience. I mean, he told me things were different and maybe one not harder than the other. Well, what are your thoughts?
I try not to put things on a hierarchy of difficulty and respect that
sense.
Each medium is incredibly difficult in its own way. I think there are mediocre or terrible actors in the world who get great editing, great lighting, you know, perfect makeup or costumes or hair that make them look better. Whereas on stage, no matter how good your costume looks, how flawless your makeup or perfectly styled your hair, you can't hide behind anything when it's just you on stage or you and your scene partner or partners. And so I think there's a no bullshit kind of barometer on stage that you really see someone's true self or whole essence poured into this work. And you can't bullshit around it. and so that sort of shows your merit or, you know, ability in that moment, at least. And to do something like theater 6, 7, 8 times a week, it's like, you know, other people in their office jobs don't just go to bat one day a week, right? You have to deliver every day. And in theater, you are delivering all those times over and over again, and that shows something, or a lack thereof, whether you like it or not.
Good. Yeah. Well, thanks for putting me in the check, because you're absolutely right. Like putting things in the hierarchies, definitely not the. I don't think that's just a good way to do anything mindset wise. Let me ask you this though, Daniel. Is someone who struggles in the theater, can TV and lighting can make up for it, but someone who's good in theater, are they always successful in TV? Or, because I would think so, right? I mean,
I would want that to be true, but I think there are different mediums in which different aspects of yourself have to be employed to tell the story. And so, the easiest thing to think of is saying you are too big for camera, and I don't know if that is really an honest critique to give to anybody, but there are subtleties and privileges with a camera being right in front of your face and what you can employ to tell story versus a 2,000 seat theater and how you are using your whole body to tell a story or your whole voice. And so I guess it's like different muscles to use if you were on a Zoom call versus if you were giving a presentation in front of 100 people in an auditorium, or whatever your job may be, you're using different aspects, assets, parts of yourself to tell that story.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting to think about. So, Daniel, I want to ask you about According to My Mother project. Yes, yeah. Yes, the inspiration behind that. Very, very interesting.
It started out as a series of Facebook posts when Facebook was the cool platform to be on, where I would just transcribe conversations I had with my mom, who lives in Orange County, California, and I'm here in New York. And so the way we relate to each other and stay connected is usually by the phone, but often text and email. And she's incredibly conservative, Christian, deeply, deeply religious, and like a crazy conspiracy theory believer, and an immigrant from Korea, and a single mother, and I'm an only child, and I am very liberally slanted, and gay and queer, and in opposition to her set of beliefs. And so while it may seem easier to not have a relationship, in many ways, we choose to engage in one, and it results in her being very homophobic or very conservative or very what I would call crazy, and she may not agree as such about her perspectives, and so writing these snippets of conversations down led to creating a short film pilot presentation about her, and now developing a TV show about the relationship between an only child and single parent, immigrant mother, conservative, liberal, Christian, agnostic, or straight and gay, dynamic, and what it would be like to imagine, instead of the kid having to go back home to live with their parents, if the parent had to move in with their child. And not only that, but starting over in New York City and being in your golden years and trying to figure out how to start anew is the premise of a TV show that hopefully someone will make on a cable platform or streaming venue near you. So
awesome.
Your
mom hates it? Oh, come on, mom.
She's also like oddly supportive in her own way.
Well, I mean, man, that's great though, man. Like I, like you said, it would be the easier thing to be like, all right, I don't even want to have a relationship.
Right.
So I really commend you for that, 'cause that is the hard thing to do. And, you know, not having parental support and acceptance. I mean, it's tough. It would be tough for any human, right? You know, I mean, this is where most of our issues come from, right? Our parents. I imagine though writing served as like sort of like therapy for this.
Totally. Right. I mean,
any what other mechanisms do you use or have you used to help like cope and accept with this situation?
I've already mentioned therapy. The writing has been a huge sort of outlet for me to try to find comedy and empathy where otherwise it would be a source of trauma or pain. And I also find creating community and in places of where you can find incredible empathy. So the Asian American community, the arts community, the gay and queer community have been sources for me to find strength and to not feel so alone, you know, that no one is really alone in their struggle. And there are other people who understand or will try to understand what you're going through. And that that can be a huge source of refuge and strength so that you aren't having to feel like you're the only one going through something. Community. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I forget where I heard it. I heard it a couple of weeks ago, but I really liked the quote. I forget who said it, but it said, love is the highest level of understanding. And that really hit me deep. And it's something I keep trying to remind myself of going forward. And so Daniel, I really appreciate your perspective and what you're doing. One last question. I'll let you get going. What are you currently reading? Any good book recommendations for me?
Oh man, I love reading. And so I just today actually just finished this book by Muriel Barbery called The Elegance of the Hedgehog that my friend Mark sent me. And so I actually like canceled all my plans today to read that, which I know is super nerdy, but it brought me joy. I just read a book called Pachinko by Min-Jin Lee. That's one of my favorite like epics that I've read in a while. It's like hundreds and hundreds of pages and they just flew by and they were really moving. And to like read something set in Korea and Japan that I didn't know about meant a lot. I in times of quarantine and the pandemic, I read Severance by Ling Ma. And that also deals with a pandemic. And so it was sort of crazy and scary, but also like titillating to see what a fictional version of a pandemic would be and to see where the parallels were to our real life. Because it's also set in New York versus like what wasn't the same or the differences from our present day. A friend of mine, R. Eric Thomas, wrote a book called Here For It, and it's like a collection of essays, autobiographical, and he's so funny. He has this like longstanding article or daily article on Elle.com where he just regurgitates the news, but in like the funniest way. And so to hear him talking about his childhood and his upbringing in this book called Here For It was nice to laugh and find comedy in what is a rather dark timeline, I think, for the world right now.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, no, I mean, comedy is essential. I mean, at least for me, it's essential.
Yeah,
laughing's essential. Totally. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so with that, that's going to conclude today's episodes of Confession of a Market Maker. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review it for us. If you want to join a pleasant and sharp group of traders, I'm in the Equities ETC room at equitiesetc.com. JJ is using Market Profile and trading futures at microefutures.com. Daniel, let the people know where they can find you and anything else you'd like the listeners to know.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Daniel K. Isaac, ISAAC, for both platforms. And please stay safe and well. And Black Lives Matter now more than ever. thank you for supporting that.
Yes, yes. JJ.
Thank you very much for being on the show, Daniel. Really, really appreciated it and learned a lot from you. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me. It's great to get to have a conversation outside of the day-to-day in this crazy time. So thanks for having me on. And it's nice to pretend to interact or, you know, actually interact outside of one's own world right now.
Yes, yes, Daniel. Appreciate you joining us. I appreciate your perspective on a lot of things. Commend you. And thank you for putting out a, you know, great show. All of you guys, great acting, great writing. We really enjoy it. It represents the trading community well, I would say. JJ would say so from especially the Wall Street side of things. So yeah, it's an honor you joined us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for watching. One more episode so far, and then we'll get back to it as soon as we can. So.
We'll be waiting.
Absolutely. All right. And so for Daniel K. Isaac, I'm Harold. He's Kumar. Make sure you guys are using stop. So
have a good night, folks.